Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Duduzile Ramela in for Jeremy Maggs this afternoon. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with sharp insights and expert analysis from the leaders and decision makers shaping the future. Live or in demand, we bring you the stories that keep you informed and ahead. Here's what you can look forward to in the next 30 minutes. South Africa is facing a critical skills shortage. In the next few moments, we'll take a look at which sectors in particular. And we also take a look at a report by RMB that shines a light on the continent's most promising investment destinations. And South Africa's energy sector is moving too slowly and is costing the country 250 billion rand a year. That's at least according to one energy analyst. We speak to him to look at that number and more. We also speak to Eugene Fasahi, Head of Strategy at Optimum Investment Group, about their business model.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Expat Web's 2025 Critical Skills Report is out and points to a country experiencing a worsening critical skills shortage. And of course, that country is South Africa. Marissa Jacobs is the Managing Director of Expat Web, and she joins us. Firstly, Marissa, good afternoon, to give us context of the report. How and why is it put together?
Good afternoon, and thank you so much for having me. So the report has been running for the last 8 years. So we've got a really rich set of data, and the report really sets out to determine the extent of the critical skills shortage in South Africa, and then the role that foreign nationals play in addressing these shortages. And then through the survey, we are able to obtain what is those top 10 occupations most in demand in South Africa, and also how acute that shortage is.
Would those top 10 then be what you then define as critical skills? What makes a skill critical?
So a skill would be deemed critical if a South African employer really struggles to recruit that skill, and to such an extent that they expand their search internationally to find an expat to fill that role. And it really is a demand and supply thing. It's not to say that we don't have those skills in South Africa. We absolutely do, but we don't have enough of them to fulfill the demand from the business sector.
Got you. So you say skills shortages are intensifying in your report that I'm reading, with 9 out of the top 10 critical areas showing increases of between 2 and 15 percentage points since 2024. And so we take a look at some of them, right? Engineers. Talk to us about that number that we're seeing of 38%. What does it mean in comparison to what we saw last year?
So engineers is definitely the most marked change. Engineers has sat at the number one of the top 10 critical skills in all of the reports that we've done, except for one, where it came in at number 2 behind ICT specialist. But this year it is at 38%. The second in line sits at 22%. So you can see how big that gap is. And then also it has grown significantly over the years. If I compare it to 2017, it was at 22%. It has then dipped into the teens, high teens, and then up to 23% last year, and this year shooting the lights out at 38%. Sure. So just showing how absolutely severe that shortage is.
Sure. One I never thought would be on the list, senior financial executives, because South Africa's got such a sophisticated financial services sector. We're seeing 19% there. Talk us through what that means in comparison also to last year.
Correct. And I think this is very much a sign of multinationals who operate in South Africa, as well as South African companies expanding their operations more broadly into Africa and globally. So we see businesses starting to look at senior financial executives who have that international experience, who are familiar with international, whether it be tax or exchange control or other financial aspects. So the speciality around that senior financial executive is changing. If we look at comparing to last year, it was at 10%, so almost doubled to 19% this year.
Healthcare professionals, which ones exactly? Because I thought we had an excess of healthcare professionals in the country. We just don't have the money, that's what we're made to understand, to place them. And so that figure of 13%, what does it mean also in comparison to last year?
Yeah, so unfortunately, it's not the case. We have a severe shortage of healthcare professionals, and especially in the specialized fields. So, if we look at a lot of it is dominated by nursing, so registered nurses and registered nurses in the surgical specialty field, emergency care professionals. Those are the occupations that we see on the list specifically when it comes to healthcare. And also, I think interesting to note around the healthcare professionals, when the list was redrafted in 2022, all healthcare professionals were completely left off the list. And such lobbying happened at such a degree that an updated list was published just a few months later to re-include healthcare professionals back onto the list. So most certainly, we do have a shortage.
Sure. One that caught my attention naturally because of the work that we do, media and marketing, sitting at 15%. Where are they looking?
Yes. So media and marketing specialists have not been on the were not on the critical skills list for many, many years, the official national list that published by Home Affairs. But we've seen the media marketing specialists creeping onto the list since 2017, since the inception of the critical skills survey. And if we look at what those specific skills are, it is brand and category marketing managers, creative designers, media strategists, sales and marketing professionals. Copywriting, also interesting. Copywriting is down though. It was 12% last year. It's down to 1%. So I do think AI is starting to play a bit of a role there.
That's scary. That's very scary. Artisans, 22%.
Yes. I mean, for most of the skill shortages, it's not a South Africa thing. It's definitely an international thing, and we are competing for critical skills globally. We see the UK has a critical skills list. Lots of countries have lists of skills that they're trying to attract. Artisans are specifically interesting because there's a big fight for artisans. So your electricians, your millwright coming in at number three on our top 10 are critical skills on the list this year.
Sure, that's very interesting. One that also caught my attention, foreign language speakers, that is at 15% in terms of the shortage. Which languages specifically?
So this is because of the rich BPO sector that we have in South Africa, especially in Cape Town, your call centers, and they specifically look for foreign language speakers. And if we look at the breakdown of which they are, a lot around French, German-speaking professionals, even Spanish-speaking professionals coming onto the list.
Yeah, so if you're wondering what to take up, there you go. For a part-time job or what is it, the gig economy or something,
Absolutely.
if you're looking for extra work, there you go. And you get to learn a new language. But for now, we say thank you very much, Marissa, for joining us on the program. Marissa Jacobs is Managing Director at Expat Web.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
So the 2025-2026 Where to Invest in Africa report by RMB is out. Looking at 31 of 55 countries, the report offers valuable insights into the continent's top investment prospects. We look at some of the major takeaways from the report with Precious Dube, macroeconomist at RMB. Thank you very much, ma'am, for your time this afternoon. Maybe let's start with how the research is put together.
So RMB puts together the research in collaboration with Boundless, a partner, our research partner. So how we put together this report is that we use a very slow-moving foundational structural methodology, which is cut across four pillars, which are economic performance and potential, looking also into market accessibility and innovation, the third pillar being economic stability and climate investment, and lastly, social and human development indicators. So across each pillars, we've got different underpinning data variables. In total, there are 20 with different weightings, which all then makes up the final rankings.
When we look at economic success, which countries are right up there? Maybe let's start with the top five.
So the top five in this year's RMB Where to Invest Index made up of Seychelles, Mauritius, Egypt, South Africa, and Morocco. Needless to say that these retain their rankings from last year's edition, just proving that our methodology is robust and it looks at structural elements with a long-term view. So ordinarily, we don't expect much jumps year on year, although due to data revisions and other specific policies, the rankings will move on a year-to-year basis.
Right. You mentioned Seychelles first. Would that then be number one? And what makes it number one?
Seychelles is number one. The reason why Seychelles is number one really is that it is the most appealing country to invest in based on the data that we use and relative to all the other 30 countries. And what puts Seychelles at the top is really that the country does well, especially in the fourth pillar, which is Social and Human Development Index. Seychelles is a country with the highest GDP per capita of all the individuals that stay in the country, so it does well in the human development indices, although it is a small country, so it's not necessarily the go-to country for everyone to invest because it's a small country with a population of less than 200,000, so there isn't much scale. But if your investments need stability and an economic climate where you can easily get your money in and out, Seychelles then is the right investment for you, and if it does not require much scale.
Where would I allocate my capital?
For you to allocate your capital, you can use the RMB Where to Invest Index, but also in addition to that, do your own due diligence and match your capital to the right destination. For instance, if your business needs scale, so therefore you need a large population. So one of the things that our report does well is that for all the 20 data metrics that I mentioned before, that we use in the methodology, the data grows, the report gives you the granular data. So you see which country is number one in terms of population size, which in this case is Nigeria, then you can allocate your capital to that. So if you need your capital to go into the country and you easily get it out, you go and allocate it to a country that is number one in terms of forex stability and liquidity. And if you need a country that's innovating quickly or faster than the rest, that you can allocate your capital to that country based on the granular data that we present on the report.
All right. So, what we hear often from investors is that they also want to go to destinations where regulation is not a burden, right? And so, which countries have a regulatory framework that is investor friendly, if you will?
So, yes, regulation is important, and we do check on that in terms of the market accessibility and investment climate pillar. And the countries in the top five precisely do well in that pillar. So, those are the countries that you actually target for your investment.
You had mentioned another metric, which I think, because you said economic, you take a look at economic success, you also take a look at a potential, right? Countries with potential.
Yes.
Which are those countries that have potential?
So smaller economies that are growing off a low base, mainly concentrated in the East and West Africa, have a lot of potential. So what we also saw with this CS iteration is that we saw the biggest climber in this rating was Côte d'Ivoire, and it was also part mostly driven by the economic potential, with the GDP growth focus that is expected to be north of 6% over the medium term. So Côte d'Ivoire moved up from 16 last year to 8 this year. And out of East Africa, Tanzania moved from 12 to 9%, also based on similar reasons of very high economic growth potential.
Thank you so much for your time, ma'am, this afternoon. Precious Dube is a macroeconomist with RMB.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's Integrated Resource Plan for 2025, which focuses on gas and nuclear generation, will cost the country dearly. The price tag, 250 billion rand. That's according to energy analyst Clyde Mallison, who joins us now to give us a little bit more context, I guess. Firstly, Clyde, thank you very much for your time on MoneyWeb at Midday. Let's start with the argument that you are making and how we got to that 250 billion rand price tag.
Okay, well, the important thing to remember is the 250 billion rand isn't the cost to build it or the additional cost to build it. It's the annual cost of what it'll cost us extra if we go according to the government plan versus a plan that I drew up with a group of primary school children in an hour at a school where I live. So I gave them software tools. And I gave them the challenge, and they came up with a plan for 2040, which would save the country 250 billion rand per year compared to the official integrated resource plan. So it's not a one-off 250 billion, it's 250 billion a
A
year.
year.
So it's staggering. It's staggering now.
That changes
We've all
everything.
become a bit, sort of, shell shock, billion, schmillion, if you know what I mean. It's a lot of money. I don't know about
And
you.
in a year, that sort of changes everything, right? Especially for the conversation. So let's look at what the government says, because especially when it comes to the IRP. So you open the IRP 2025 document, and under what is the objective or purpose of the IRP, the government says security of electricity supply. Then it goes on to say minimize the cost of electricity to the economy. So what is it that they have come up with and that these very bright young people have come up with? And in the middle, what's the disparity?
Well, first of all, the reason for working with primary school children is not to disparage anyone, but just to show that when you have an open mind and no fear, and you don't carry any legacy sort of fear about what the situation is. Young children are open-minded, they're not scared, so they just go for it. In the government plan, because of all the load shedding we've had in the past, they've quite frankly focused on security of supply. They've said, we will never have load shedding again because, boy, we're going to build wind and solar and batteries and nuclear and gas. And one thing can be sure. And then they say, oh, and we're going to try and make it affordable. Well, the answer they came up with is 250 billion rand a year less affordable than what the people that were open-minded came up with.
The open-minded people,
Well,
what are they suggesting?
the difference is that, first of all, the difference is the plan that the school children came up with had no nuclear, no gas, no coal. That's the first point. So it was predominantly wind and solar with lots and lots of storage. Now, the government plan actually had quite a lot of wind and solar as well. So the school kids' plan only had about double the solar. This is now by 2040. So that doesn't sound extreme. It had 1.5 times the amount of wind, which once again doesn't sound out of kilter, but it had 7 times the amount of storage. Because obviously, when you're relying on wind and solar predominantly, these times when you've got excess, like in the daytime when the sun's shining, and we all know the sun doesn't shine at night, so you have to have storage. You store on a daily basis, like anyone who's got solar on their roof and batteries. You fill your battery in the daytime and you use it at night. And so you've got to have lots of storage. Now, the interesting thing is the government had quite a bit of storage, but they never used it because they had so much generation. They filled their storage on day one, if you know what I mean, and then they never had to empty it because they had so much supply, and that's why it was so much more expensive. They weren't using their storage. They were using their storage as backup. Like in case there's load shedding, we've got storage. And the secret is to cycle your storage on a daily basis. It's there for a working purpose, not for an emergency. And that's the basic difference.
Got you. And so I was very interested when the electricity minister came out to say, hey, nuclear. And I was like, weren't we here a couple of years ago? Wasn't there a furor? But anyway, we're not there now. But this 52 billion rand, this price tag each and every single year, who's going to be paying for it, right? Because
250 billion. Well, the
250
consumer,
billion.
us. Yeah,
Oh.
in 2040 we'll be using about close to 400 terawatt hours. Just to put that in perspective, we currently use about a 230 terawatt hours. So we will have almost not quite doubled our consumption by 2040. I think it's 1.6 or whatever it is of the current consumption. And in order to do it primarily with renewables, which will allow then for a dignified shutting down of the coal fleet, not an overnight shutting down. We will have something like 90 gigawatts of solar, Now, 1 gigawatt is one stage of load shedding, just to put it in perspective. So we would have 90 gigawatts of solar, 60 gigawatts of wind, 40 gigawatts of storage, and then 5 gigawatts of nuclear, or 7 gigawatts of nuclear, according to the official plan. And you can see 90, 60, 45. That nuclear will be a thin red stripe, and all it will do is get in the way of the wind and solar and storage, quite frankly. It'll be not fit for purpose. It'll be a thin red line that'll. In fact, when we modelled it after the school children had come up with their model, I simply removed the nuclear from the government model, the official model, and all that happened is that the price dropped by $100 billion a year in their model, and the storage they'd put in started being used then. So when I removed the nuclear from the government model, it reduced their annual generation cost by 100 million rand, just removing the nuclear. And we still had security of supply. It just made space for the wind and solar to do their job, as it were, and use the storage.
I guess also the reason behind the who's paying the price ultimately question is because you've got so many donors who are falling over themselves giving countries money to make this move to renewable energy. And so you even forget who committed last week towards South Africa's path to renewable energy. And so in the long term, I guess, how should, not even long term, but even now, help us out how to understand who's on board with what is supposed to be happening also, because there's so much around this. Every day almost we're getting news about who's come on board, what is being done. Here's the new thing.
Here's the story. Yeah. Here's the story. We don't need any help from anyone. We're talking about the new fleet will save us money. It'll be an investment. It won't cost us anything because it'll be an investment, and the return on that investment will be marvelous. So it's not a cost. The argument actually is about who's going to get the saving, if you see what I'm getting at.
Right.
And great, what I would like to see the climate finance doing, all these people you've just spoken about, I would love to see that money not spent, but used as collateral for the poor. So I would like the poor to own the new fleet, using climate finance as collateral, and actually the poor borrowing money from local banks, with that climate finance as collateral, and then paying back the money to the local banks, but the dividends they would get from the new fleet that they would be selling to all of us would be greater than the loans they had to pay back to the bank. Mm-hmm. And then once their loan was paid back, they would have a pension for the rest of their lives, or for at least 25 years. So that's my real vision, is to have a citizen-owned new electricity generation fleet that actually switches people from SASA grants to renewable energy dividends. That's my vision. And when we do that, on top of that, we've still got a saving of 250 billion rand a year. Because that 250 billion rand is the saving, not the cost of putting it in the new stuff. So we've got the sort of green bond dividend potential for 10 million households in South Africa. And as a country, we're saving 250 billion a year. And sorry, last point is we'll save more than all of that money on health costs. Mm-hmm. Health costs of burning fossil fuels are greater than the cost of generating electricity. And once you factor those in together with climate costs, then renewables are not just cheaper than fossil fuels, they're 10 times cheaper.
All right, Clyde, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. Clyde Mallinson is an energy analyst.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's asset management industry is said to be entering a new era of collaboration and skill. The Optimum Investment Group's recent partnership with Obsidian Capital reflects a global shift to what analysts are calling business model alpha, a trend where strategic alliances and technology-driven efficiency are reshaping how investment firms compete and grow. We're now joined to take a look at what this means for investors in the broader market by Eugene Fasahi, Head of Strategy at Optimum Investment Group. Thank you very much, Eugene, for your time this afternoon. Maybe let's start with that term, business model alpha, which is becoming a buzzword in global finance. For those who are not familiar with it, what does it mean? Or for those of us who are not familiar with it, what does it mean, and how does the partnership between Optimum Investment Group and Obsidian Capital reflect the shift?
Yeah, I think it's important just to unpack to the listeners first, because business model alpha, what does the alpha even mean? And the investment landscape beta refers to just getting the similar type of return of what the market is giving you, where alpha, you actually have active management to try and outperform what the market is. So normally having an asset manager or portfolio manager picking these better performing stocks. So what does business model alpha mean? And at the end of the day, it means that the business model or the asset manager outperforms its peers. So business alpha refers to the way a business can potentially create value for an investment firm. It is different to investment alpha, as I just described, which is based on portfolio management decisions, and operational alpha, which is all about utilizing better data and technology. Business alpha, by contrast, revolves about attracting and retaining clients. Now, there's many ways this can be achieved, but one example is to create these unique, cost-effective investment solutions that deliver on the risk-return objective of their respective status.
Now, the McKinsey Asset Management 2025 report talks about consolidation and collaboration as key to survival. Why are alliances and joint ventures mission critical for asset managers?
So we've seen this massive rise in especially the allocations to passive portfolio managers. So they're some of the biggest in the world. Now, their costs are very, very low. And you basically just get a similar type of return of what the markets give you at that point in time. Now, the market has run very, very strongly. But of course, now there's also this pressure on the active management side to reduce costs. So just to give an example, over the last year, close to 60% of all inflows has been into passive funds across the globe. So we are seeing a lot of pressure on specifically costs. So that's one of the key features on the portfolio management or the asset management side. But we also, the markets are not always going to increase as much as they have. There's still this need for alternative assets such as hedge fund and infrastructure. And the only way you can get that is if you have, as you've mentioned, this critical mass, basically. So aside from this pressure on fees, the economies of scale and compliance, I think everyone on who's listening understands the compliance burdensome continues to increase. Technology, especially around cybersecurity, and of course, distribution and marketing. So you need that economies of scale at asset management level to make sure that you get a good cost-effective solution to the client.
You mentioned pressure on fees and you mentioned technology. What role is technology playing in building cost-efficient, agile platforms for investment management today?
Well, technology is here to stay, Dudu. I think we're all being bombarded with artificial intelligence and how to actually use it at the end of the day. But mergers can provide access to new technologies that enhance infrastructure, streamline investment processes, and enable a more personalized client experience. I think at the end of the day, all listeners here, we know we get bombarded by information all the time, and you need to personalize that. You need to give them real-time information all the time because everyone is being bombarded. So technology can play a crucial role in this to enable asset managers to deliver a best product to the client.
What have you made of the theme of the democratization of private markets? How do you see this changing South Africa's investment landscape?
Dude, I just want to quickly unpack private markets so all the listeners understand what we specifically refer to. So historically, yes, it's relatively easy for investors to invest into the equity market or the bond market or even offshore. But we continue to see these private market opportunities. And I'm going to use an example, something like a solar farm in the middle of the Karoo or water desalination plant in Cape Town. And we're not talking here about 2 or 3 million rand. These are 10 billion, 20 billion rand investments we're talking about. Now, historically, they could have approached larger institutional investors and say, come and invest in this unique opportunity. Solar is a great example. It's here to stay. You have a constant buyer, water desalination, another great example of infrastructure. Now, if you put lots of retail investors together, you actually have the scale to give them access to these unique opportunities. So the more we as an industry work together, the more of these unique opportunities we can bring to the retail market and ensure that everyone within their retail, their retirement annuity, their tax-free saving have access to this unique opportunity set.
When you speak of unique opportunities, local firms are embracing global trends. What opportunities or risks even do you see emerging for South Africa's asset management sector in the next 5 years?
Well, I think I just explained the best one is the market expansion, Didi. So there's this awesome new products we can take to clients, these awesome new investments we can take to clients if we work together. So it's going to be very difficult to do that as a small, relatively independent one. I think another one I've mentioned is technology. Mm-hmm. Tech is here to stay and really just to make it easier for the end investor and to enhance the client experience at the end of the day. And also to create cost-effective solutions to clients. So really personalize it to a certain extent to make sure that we do meet the client's needs at the end of the day. Every single person out there needs are different. Mm-hmm. We can't just assume, oh, because I'm investing, it all looks the same. Everyone's got a different timeline of when they need these capital, and that really the tech can help with that. So that's all the opportunities. There's a lot more, in my opinion. One of the biggest risks that always exists with any type of merger is cultural misalignment. So we've seen that before where especially larger life insurance or banks buy asset managers and there's massive cultural alignment. And of course, then you see a loss of key talent that happens. So there might be some really good talent in the businesses, but they, because of this cultural misalignment, doesn't work out. Others that are risk that we need to look out for is failure to achieve these synergies, because on paper, it might look quite sexy and fun and interesting, but to actually implement it is not always possible. And of course, there's always the risk of less competition too, where you might just sit with a couple of really large players out there and not these unique solutions.
Sure. Thank you very much, Eugene, for your time this afternoon. Eugene Fasahi is Head of Strategy at Optimum Investment Group. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can also catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you very much for making us part of your day. Jeremy Maggs is back with you tomorrow afternoon. Bye-bye.